Hey, Jeff, we're back.
We are back. How's it going, Steve?
We're back for another episode of The Overscan.
We did. We made it one more week.
We did another. Well, hopefully this is another week in a row. I mean, hopefully we get this done by next Wednesday, and then it's every Wednesday.
How many subscribers did we lose on the last video, Steve?
Two.
Steve, if this is the direction of the channel, I'm leaving.
I'm gonna unsubscribe. Into the vertical blind, generation Atari. Into the vertical blind, generation Atari. Well, okay. I mean, that's fine. Whatever you guys want to do.
This isn't all we're doing, though, right?
No, this isn't all we're doing. We have other all sorts of other stuff coming up. It's just we're trying to find
series.
We're trying to find something to do on a more regular basis.
Right.
But to do that, it can't be a podcast filled with stories that are created and recorded. And stuff. It has to be something. If it's more regular, it has to be something that we can mechanize a little bit and have discussions a little bit more free form, because there's just no way to create all that content. It doesn't mean we aren't going to have that other content. It just means that comes at a different pace. But I've been noticing that a regular thing is probably good. And so to do a regular thing, what we call the overscan, is we try, and we're not always perfect about this, I think. We try to find things that have been overlooked, or sometimes they're just things that we're really excited about. But yeah. But that's what the overscan is. So
we're not going to dig down and try to find like TRS-80 color computer only news, right? We're going to find stuff that we're interested in. I don't mind the TSR-80.
I was going to say, what are you talking about? What if there was something about the TRS-80?
What I mean is we're not going to go really far out just to find something that's not covered. We're going to find something that interests us and also we think may interest people that come to this channel. And we'll also cover just huge things.
Hey, if it's TRS-80 and it's good
and
it's interesting, like I think someone posted a picture of, was it Mountain King or what's the one with the donkey? The game with the donkey? Is that Mountain? That's not Mountain King.
No.
Canyon Climber.
Canyon Climber.
And I remember that we played that on a TRS-80 at Radio Shack one day.
We did.
In one summer day when mom was washing clothes. And so we may have content about the TRS-80, you know? So we can't really say that.
Well, and we will. No, what I was saying is we're not going to go out of our way to find just nuggets.
We're not just going to go dig up anything. It just has to be related. I mean, it's mostly Atari content still.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to fart on the TRS-80. I love that thing. We used to go see it all the time. That's not what I was saying. I was saying we're going to find things that are off the beaten path. But they're still on our beaten path.
But let's be honest. The first episode was a little rough.
It was very rough. We lost two subscribers. So
the idea was not to lose two subscribers. And that's why it's the boardroom. But I swear we're going to get rid of this thing that says the boardroom in the next one. Sure. Okay. Ready?
Okay.
Atari News.
Atari News. That is a great transition.
Okay, the first thing. This thing that came out this week on Time Extension, this piece of news about the Atari 50th collection, the Atari 50 XP collection, that with these 10 games, each had a little light-up thing on the cartridge, to complete the set, you had to get all 10, and they all kind of they go together to spell out Atari 50. They didn't interest me at the time because they were just the same games in light up cartridges. I never really cared that much about light up cartridges. I didn't care, but it's neat. I mean, whoever wants it is cool, right?
It's cool.
But I'm just saying it didn't really interest me that much, especially because it was expensive. And it was almost like the I Am Rich app on the iPhone. It's like I can't afford it, and there's no reason for me to get it. But
okay, wait. Wait, what is the I Am Rich app?
You didn't know? Okay, there was back in the early days of the iPhone, someone made an I Am Rich app, and it was basically a screen that said I Am Rich, and it cost $1,000. And that's all it was. And so the point was, if you could afford the I Am Rich app, it meant you were rich. And Apple decided that that was not a good use of the iPhone platform. And to this day, I don't understand why, because the amount of utter garbage on there doesn't really,
Right.
I mean, you might as well have an I Am Rich app.
That's fantastic. Anyway, I just must have forgotten about that. I must have blocked it out.
So so here, someone had posted, there was an article about how Crystal Castles in this collection was not the right version, or some people got the wrong version. And also, some people got copies of Haunted House with the PCB reversed. And that's, and you know, that's the same thing that we had happen with the Aqua Venture and those other XP cartridges. When they did the re-releases, they were, the PCBs were mixed up, and you had to go in and turn them around, which is fine. It's fine that there's a way to do it, but it's just another indicative of Atari's XP problems with manufacturing and shipping. They just keep going. You know, last week we talked about Mr. Run and Jump, and how that still isn't shipping.
It still isn't shipping.
Anyway, what happened is the person got a response back from Atari customer support, and Atari customer support is notoriously information free. Let's say that. Okay, I'm sure they're trying extremely. Trying extremely hard to do what they do, but they're mostly information free when they send you emails about the status of your order. And in the email they got, they said basically they weren't going to be replaced, right? And they were SOL.
Yeah.
Atari put an update, or someone from Atari, representing Atari, put an update on Atari Age that said this: this article and some of the videos that have been posted on this topic have been the expected mix of accurate and interactive information. I got to stop right there. It's only expected because Atari gives no information. So anyway, they said, Atari basically says here that that's wrong. They'll try to replace them, and that's fine. It's just indicative of another Atari XP shipping issue. These just keep coming, and something's got to give. That's all.
Yeah, I think they need to give Albert a staff, and I think he's in Austin or Texas or wherever. Give him a staff, and help him get his cartridges out, and help him get these out, and put him in charge of this. That's what they should be doing.
They need to fix their supply chain issues is what they need to do, Jeff.
They need to put someone in charge of who knows what they're doing, who's done this before and has been successful.
Right.
There's only one person really that's done that in the Atari community. There's others, but done it at scale.
Next up.
Okay.
The Epic
awesome.
Handheld Collection on the Nintendo Switch. Now, I bought this. I love it because I love these games. It's pretty much the same collection that came out on the Evercade. There's no Lynx branding anywhere. It's just the Epix collection, but we know these are Lynx games. The games do say they're licensed to Atari, so that's the one sort of bone they throw to Atari, but almost everything else is removed. The games are Blue Lightning, California Games, Electrocop, Gates of Xenocon, Todd's Adventures in Slime World, and Zola Mercenary, and anyone who knows about the Lynx will know that those are some of the best games. They also have filters and game saves and a bunch of other stuff. Let's play a little bit of this video for it. And there it is. Nice looking collection.
That's a great little video. I mean, so of those six games, we had all six of those. All six of them are absolutely classics.
It's only $12, too. So $2 a game. I think it's totally worth it. The Epics, the people own the Epics IP. I don't know who it is. I hope that they have some relation to the people who worked at Epics back in the day. Epics is still one of my favorite classic game companies ever. I wish someone would do a real sort of museum exploration of Epics, you know, automated simulations, Epics, and all the things they did. That would be really cool. But all right.
You know what? These same games are available on the Evercade and the Lynx pack, and it's fantastic. So you don't have to buy this one if you have an Evercade, get that. Although the Atari, it's probably really rare now since the Atari license went away.
It is fun. Yeah, I think this is what happened to it. It is fun though. You can on the the Switch is handheld, so you also. It's fun to play that way too. So the other thing I want to talk about is time extension. I noticed that this website is having a lot more Atari content now. That story before, this story that's written by Lewis Packwood, basically a story based on a story in his book, Curious Video Game Machines, that we talked about last time. But it's really cool. I think that time extension, I have You know, it's not always that always. I mean, we don't always find a site that has Atari news on it. So.
The interesting thing about this one is, you know, the quote: "Most of my engineers were stoned." Nolan Bushnell on the failure of Atari Music. You know, Atari Music basically was a way to get stoned and watch music videos. Right?
Yeah.
So, now the great thing about the video music is there was one at the VCF SoCal.
Yes.
Right as you walked in. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I still want one of these really bad, or
this is very interesting because I read, this is the two stories that I read in this book we covered in the last 2 weeks. The one about Chris Crawford and this one. These are the two that I read first. And so very good. That book, we're still going to have a link to the book down there again to Amazon. To pick it up. It's a fantastic book. Like I said last week, it is the alternative history of video games.
I wish Atari could find a way to re-release a HDMI version of video music that kind of, hooked into your Bluetooth speaker or something. It would be really, really cool with this exact same animations. But
I would like to see this show up, the Atari-branded video music machine show up for Christmas at all of those stores that sell like those things that are only out for Christmas, like the record players and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so people could buy it, hook it up, and get stoned with their legal weed or their non-federally prohibited weed now, category 3 instead of 1 or whatever it is, watching the video music machine, because those things have been showing up.
It could be kind of like one of those all-in-one record players. So it could be a Bluetooth speaker as well, and then maybe it could it could have a little like 420 by what is it, 350, whatever the NTSC.
420, Steve?
I did. I say 420. Yeah, I did.
Okay. Anyway,
whatever an NTSC sized screen that the images play on instead of hooking it up to your TV.
Karaoke machine.
I would literally buy that.
That's pretty cool. Okay, so enough about weed and
with an output to go to your regular TV too, if you want.
Oh like, yeah, of course, of course. HDMI,
both out analog and HDMI out, so you can go to your CRT if you want as well.
Right,
that's what I want. Atari, are you listening? Video music is the key to something. I don't know what it is. Okay,
so
next.
To your Christmas season.
Yes. Okay, Atari.com. So I thought we would try to do this if we had every week or every couple weeks we would check in on Atari Age. And say, hey, Atari Age, what updates are there on Atari Age that would interest us that might fall through the cracks? So here's one, the one on the left. So we just talked about this. Last week, I think.
I think orders from Atari are going to come up every single week.
We're not going to stop talking about Atari orders until it's fixed. So it looks like the Atari 7800, the controller and the carts that they sold in January, I believe, that were supposed to be out in May are now pushed to June 7th, which isn't too bad. I mean, it said in May, now June 7th. That's okay. But okay, and here's the other one, Jeff. The Atari 2600 Plus firmware update. Guess what?
Still not released?
Still not formally released. I don't even know if there's another version out there. We haven't installed on my 2600 Plus, but it's been months now. They know there's fixes, but they haven't really released it officially, which I think is not great. So maybe we'll get an update.
I bet that PlayOn has been working on something else. He doesn't have any time for this at the moment.
I think they need to honor their commitments and fix things that don't work. So that's okay, Ben. But I'm sure there's other people there or whatever, but something's got to happen, right? You can't just, releasing a product these days is not just it ships and you run away. Like, that doesn't happen, especially these types of products. If you're going to do that, you might as well not do it. You should find someone else to do it. I'm not saying that's what Ben did.
Well, they
I'm just saying
that, they have PlayOn do it.
But I'm saying that the beta update, the firmware update needs to come out. That's all.
Yes. Yeah, no, of course. Of course. It does.
All right.
Books. Okay, so
you tell me about this book you like.
Last week we covered some new books, and I wanted to make sure that we cover at least, every week or every other week or whenever we can. I think we've decided we want to cover a classic book that maybe fell through the cracks for some people, or maybe, you know, everybody knows about these. But I wanted to start with one of the first of the three books that got us excited when we decided pretty much we weren't going to be able to make games, about working in IT and data processing, as it was called back then. The first book was Cliff Stoll's The Cuckoo's Egg, Tracking a Spy Through the Maze of Computer Espionage. And this is a book about a guy, Cliff Stoll, working at Berkeley. And he's a grad student there, I think, as an astronomer. He's also working in the computer lab and the computer that supports the astronomers. And this always rang true for me and you, always bridging two different sides of things, or always being a quote foo-foo of one or the other. He said the astronomers call him a great computer guy, and the computer guys call him a great astronomer. So neither one. He really was sort of an imposter. He had the imposter syndrome in both arenas. And anyway, this book is about him tracking. There's an accounting error. And at the time when I heard accounting error, it gave me shivers because I hated accounting classroom. But that's not what it meant. There's an error in accounting the time on one of the servers. Turns out it was because there were some hackers coming in from West Germany. And he tracks them all the way back to West Germany and gets them arrested. And if anyone has read Cyberpunk, the book by Katie Hafner that starts with Kevin Mitnick, the last story in there, I think the last one or the second one, is about the same West German hackers. So, and we'll talk about that Cyberpunk book in a couple weeks, but this is where a very classic, classic book on hackers, computer systems, IT, all well before the World Wide Web was available to everyone.
Yeah, and kind of what it's excited about networks and about the internet, yes, before there was really a World Wide Web. So on that note, it's by Cliff Stoll. I love this book. He was a hero to me for a few years. So Cliff Stoll in 1995 put out a book called Silicon Snake Oil. And this book was notorious at the time because in 1995 it was Netscape, it was Java had just been created, or just the first version of Java came out. The internet was the next huge big thing. The World Wide Web was the next huge big thing. And right then, Cliff Stoll puts out this book that's just like, hey, internet, you suck. and in his book he had a bunch of reasons why he thought the internet was never going to be big, that people were wasting their time. And the first one was the internet is too big. So he says this, he says, in 1986, the budding internet linked perhaps 60,000 people. Today there's well beyond 2 million and 100,000 more join every month. What once felt like a small town is now a congested, impersonal New York City of the mind, where you often don't recognize the person you're talking to. Because, you know, when he was doing it, they kind of knew the scientists, or at least were aware of the scientists they were talking to and stuff like that. And he's like, hey, look, I don't know who these people are. I mean, we experienced similar things when we were on, like,
right,
music news groups and stuff like that. And then when it became wider, it was actually harder to have those conversations. But it didn't mean it was getting any worse. But Cliff was certain that this was gonna make the internet not work. Okay.
Well,
he also said,
old man yells at clouds.
Yeah, old man. He on software, he says, okay, I don't care how you spend your money, but I do care how schools, libraries, governments spend my money, and much of the software and services being sold aren't worth the floppy disk they're recorded on. Was not happy about mid-90s software. Of course, I knew mid-90s software is actually pretty damn good. So,
right,
but it really depends on his perspective. On the promise of computers. But over the past few years, I've experienced something of a change of heart. What started out so various, so beautiful, so new, now appears to be less than meets the eye. Occasionally, I yearn for the good old days, back when computers squatted in glass rooms and mechanical teletypes clattered. You could see the bits on the punch card. You could smell the ozone and the printer jam. So, I mean, you know, he wishes for a time before computers were available to people.
So this is boomer liking tactile things.
It is really, yeah. Then on speed, he said, yet Yet I claim those promises are myths, grounded in the dreams of an information Shangri-La that can never be realized. And were it to happen, many of us would prefer to remain behind. At least such is the myth. In reality, sharing business hours on the internet is painfully slow. It sometimes takes a minute for each keystroke to travel from your keyboard to the target system. So, yeah, I mean, dial-up and networks were slow at the time. This is the funny one about e-commerce. He says, I disagree. Network authentication software can never give the same sense of trust as a face-to-face business transaction. No computer network or pretty graphics can ever replace the salespeople that can make our society work. And of course, obviously...
No, wait. I want to say something about that one. He's not wrong. Okay? It did happen, but I still would rather give my money to a person than... Amazon.
True,
right?
but think about the time that this was that he wrote this book, right?
Yes,
that's the problem. He became we'll talk about it.
He became a pariah.
Right. He talked all about how computer games, then too, computer games develop transient skills which soon become mundane. Of the players who seized on Pac-Man and Pong, how many still play these games today? And of course, I'm thinking we
lots of
now,
us
now. But these are the 3-year-old multi-user dungeons on the internet are passe today. Contrast these with poker, Go, baseball, Monopoly. He's saying that like modern physical games, will always be played, but computer games are transient.
Maybe at the time.
He wasn't happy with any of it, but he did have some prophetic takes too. So a lot of that stuff he was kind of right about. But he said this on writing. But instead of an internet-inspired renaissance, mediocre writing and poorly thought-out arguments roll onto my modem. Email and postings to network news groups are frequently ungrammatical, misspelled, and poorly organized. After trolling up and down the Usenet from alt-best-usenet to zer.z.nets.telecom.modem, I rarely find prose that's articulate and creative. I mean, he's right. Like writing has got pretty terrible and is still pretty terrible.
And writing's hard. Writing's difficult. So when you give it to the masses.
Working from home. Oh, I doubt our offices will be replaced by minions working from home. I mean, this is without a pandemic. The lack of meetings and personal interaction isolates workers and reduces loyalty. Nor is a house necessarily an efficient place to work, what with its constant interruptions and lack of office fixtures. Perhaps it'll work for jobs where no one has to meet anyone else, like a data entry or telephone sales. What a way to turn a home into a prison. I mean, I kind of feel that way about working from home sometimes.
I mean, this is another one. Some of his things were very prophetic. This is all true. At the time, I think no one wanted to hear it.
I don't think anyone even thought everyone would be working from home. Like, that was still like a pipe dream. On email sucking, this is about a political email that it sent out. So that's what this is referencing. Such a sampling of email isn't a good dipstick for the electorate's opinions. Not only is email underrepresentative, it is easy to pad a petition campaign with thousands of duplicate email messages. Someone can just program a computer to send multiple copies. Handwritten letters, which require dedication, reflection, are far more serious vehicles of grassroots opinions. I mean, what he says here is absolutely true. Email became a absolute, graveyard of destruction. Like, you can't really trust email for anything. So he was right. And, even though at the time email wasn't actually that bad.
Email is a cesspool.
On privacy, listen to this. Many people are uneasy about having such data collected and downright concerned that it may be stored and shared. You may have nothing to hide, but even then, some of these details could be used in ways that are annoying, if not intrusive. Out of this worry grows an absolute position. Don't let Big Brother collect information about me. I mean, that's probably his most spot on thoughts on privacy, which are absolutely 100% true right now, even more so, right? And finally, on self-publishing, which I think is pretty good. With everyone able to upload their works to the network, the internet begins to resemble a publisher's slush pile. It's up to the reader to separate out the dregs. What's missing from the network are genuine editors. And we've actually said this for a long time. We said this when Apple would allow anyone to publish games for no money on the iTunes store. It needs an editor, or it just becomes it's a race to the bottom. And that's self-publishing books, that's AI. So was he right? Well, he wasn't entirely wrong. Right. At the time, everyone thought he was full of crap. But I think we need to look back and go, you know what? Like he was wrong about the technicals because maybe he was a technical guy. So he was upset about like speed and capacity and stuff. And he was right. It wasn't up to it, but that stuff was fixed. But he wasn't wrong about content, and he wasn't wrong about social issues. And unfortunately, he disappeared after this. But I think this book needs to be looked at again.
Me too.
As fairly prophetic about 2024. It's still obviously it's still a little naive, but I mean, many of the things that he was upset about or thought would happen did happen, and he was right. So that's Silicon Snake Oil. That's Cliff Stoll.
Yeah. So read them both. I think people who look for something to read or listen to. I don't know if you can listen to Silicon Snake Oil. I know that the other one is on the first one.
Yeah, I mean, you'll be annoyed if you read. There's a lot of stuff in there that really makes him sound like a Luddite, even though he says he's not. It does go boomer, boomer, boomer all over the place. But even in 1995,
it was the first "Hey Boomer" moment.
But I think that if you read between the lines, it should. I think this book needs to be reevaluated as a kind of warning sign.
OK Boomer note. I'm saying on the OK Boomer note. This was the first book that was OK Boomer. And in that, there is some truth to it and also some falsehoods about it, just like all OK Boomer moments when they're right tied to a person, right? Very much so, you know, as a pejorative, but then he's very much right. And that happens with a lot of people who say things now that just get lambasted for it. And then there's truth in what they're saying. But the young people... The young people don't want to hear it.
All right, let's go.
Oh, excitement of the week is next.
Excitement of the week. Okay. My excitement of the week.
Cool.
Oh, yes. My excitement of the week. My Atari 2600 movie cart showed up. So this is a cartridge that takes an SD card with a specially formatted movie. I think it's 80 by 192, and it will after it. There's a converter for it. It'll take any video and convert it. It only allows up to 4 gigabytes. It can read, but it will play the movie on your Atari 2600 through the TIA chip.
The TIA chip, Steve.
The TIA, not the TIA.
Television what? The television what?
Interface adapter. The TIA. Jeff. It's the TIA.
Okay, the TIA.
So my goal is to take one of our little YouTube videos that we've made and put it on there to play. It doesn't come with a cartridge case, so I ran into my local retro store yesterday and bought a few copies of Combat for a couple bucks each so I could take them apart and have the cases for them. This is very hard to get. I managed to snag it one day just by clicking on the buy it link. Usually, you know, two or three go up and then are sold out immediately. So it's a cool, it's one of these like unnecessary cool things. It's kind of fun that the Atari 2600 are finally getting these.
Where did you get it? Buy it on where?
It's this tyndall.products.com. It's at the bottom. I signed up for the mailing list. If you see you can sign up for a mailing list when it's out of stock, and then they will send you updates when they're available.
That's really cool. So somebody makes a few of these, and basically people are already waiting in line to get them.
Yep.
That is a great hobby right there.
All right. Our videos.
Okay, so the reason I don't have an excitement of the week is this. Because I spent all of my free time working on the last video for this podcast and this video, which is the next video in the series, the Atari ST Run and Gun. This was the action platformer Run and Gun number 3, numbers 30 to 21. And while working on this video, I came up with my rant of the week, which is next. Okay, so first, let's talk about this video. It should be up right now to watch. In this video, the Atari ST Run and Gun number 3, these are the 10 games that are in my countdown are from 30 to 21. Stormtrooper, Sly Spy, Fire Force, Bionic Commando, Zone Warrior, Mission Elevator, Platoon, Ball, The Untouchables, and Exelon. And while doing this, obviously this is the, all I got to play this week. So my excitement of the week was Zone Warrior for multiple reasons. So let's go to my explanation of why. Okay, so this is my excitement was talking about crap ST ports based around Zone Warrior. And I'll explain exactly why.
So what is a crap ST port, Jeff? What is a crap ST port?
Okay, I'm going to explain what a crap ST port is right now. So Amiga owners, when the ST was the lead platform before the Amiga 500 came out, this is between 1986 and 1989, really, even to 1990 for the most part, Amiga owners rarely got their own full port from the ground up. They normally got what was an ST game with some sound slapped onto it, okay? Better sounds, or sometimes nothing, sometimes not even better sounds. Many of the times, and they were right in calling some of these crap ST ports, because they were just crap ST ports. But Amiga owners failed to understand that the port could have been better on both machines. And here's my example. OutRun was crappy on both, could have been so much better on both machines, but the ST was the lead one. So when the Amiga one came out, the Amiga guys are saying, why don't I have one that looks like the Sega Genesis? I have this one that's barely as good as the Commodore 64 one. In fact, I bet the Commodore 64 one is probably better, but all of these Ocean ports were kind of bad. I'm sure there were some good ones. Now, the real blame for crap ports to both the ST and the Amiga was the software houses that were lazy at the time. They were charging double or triple the price of an 8-bit game for the ST and Amiga ones, and not putting a lot of work into them.
But is this because now are they charging more because finally they could get out of the budget mentality and start charging a good amount?
Also,
for games?
It cost more to make these, and also they knew these people had more money because they had a computer that was more
expensive. And it's no longer a kid in his bedroom making a lot of these games. It's their actual companies.
Yeah, there are budget games for both of these machines, but they usually are not. They usually come out as post. Expensive commercial ports. So the budget games were once expensive commercial ports rather than budget games just being released as budget games. Both the Amiga and the ST did get software from budget lines, but not like the 8-bit European and
don't English get me wrong. Okay. I think the bedroom coder thing is amazing. When we lost that, we lost something very special. I think across here too, because we had bedroom coders here too, not in the same, in a different way. And we lost that as well. So
I wanted to mention that the Atari, the J Minor machines, like the Amiga, got this a lot when the Amiga finally won, but the Atari 8-bit never did. The Atari 8-bit came out, and at the beginning, it got all Apple II, kind of crappy Apple II ports. Now, that changed when people understood the machine, and the Amiga got the same thing, too. The Atari ST rarely got that STE, they figured out the machine, or the ST figured out the machine. And so the Atari ST never really got past that point. There are some great games that came out later, but they never got that full people understanding the machine. Happening now with Jonathan, who's making the racing games, though. We'll get to those in another video. Okay, so about Zone Warrior. This is funny. Zone Warrior came out in 1991. So the reason I wanted to particularly talk about Zone Warrior was it was not a crap ST port to the Amiga. It's a crap port to the ST from the Amiga. And this happened a lot too. Sometimes the Amiga got an incredible game and the ST got a bad port, or a port that was based around the wrong thing. So Shadow of the Beast, for instance, incredible game on the Amiga. The ST got a decent port of it, looked just okay, but the gameplay was the same on both. The gameplay wasn't very good. The ST port focused too much on trying to make parallax scrolling instead of a good game. This is a game where Zone Warrior is a game where the Amiga game came out, and the Amiga game was pretty bad, and we're going to show a little bit of that video. And so what they did was they didn't try to improve it to the ST. They didn't have to, because both the games were the same. The Amiga one is hilarious because of everything they added to the beginning of the game to make it seem like it's worth something, and you just get the same crap you gave on both machines. The one magazine must have been paid to like this game. They gave it 92%. No one else did. The programming in the game is pretty good, but the level design, how they chose the game, is not very good. And let's take a look at it now. So I have a little video of it. I made a 3-minute video that it shows the ST and the Amiga version. So let's first take we're going to show the ST one, and listen to it. Not very good sounds. I wish I could fast forward. Okay, you get some of those bad sounds. It's okay. And then you get sort of this NES level sort of scrolling shooter that kind of wants to be Turrican, but it's not. And it's okay. I mean, the gameplay's kind of fun, actually. And the technically, it's well done. But when you get to the Amiga version, this is hilarious.
I like that music.
Use sampled sounds, but you're getting the exact same game. So this is EA, who loved the Amiga, made great Amiga games. They were expecting in 1991 for a game like this to compete with games, full price games on the Genesis. They made a great beginning, and they just released the same kind of okay game for both machines. They could have made a great game on both machines. The STE was out at this time. The Amiga had, there was years and years of Amiga development to make great games. They could have, the ST and STE ones could have easily had tracker music. And it's just, I wanted to both rant and say that the game is fun and I liked playing it. It was one of my favorites of this 10. But the fact that it's just 1991, it's just so poor for that time. And to show that, yes, the ST did get crap Amiga ports. The ST game should have been better than this, and show sort of the Amiga game, just like with the early ST games that get ported to the Amiga that should have been better on both of them.
See, now when I see this, and I think it looks good, but I understand your point. It's really the opposite of the crap ST port.
Right. It's a good game. It's like the ST. It could have been better on both machines. It should have been better on the Amiga, and it should have been better on the ST. The exact same thing when they were porting games to the Amiga from the ST early on when they did OutRun, should have been better on both machines, and it was crap on both machines. It came around in a circle. Amiga guys can't just complain that it was the ST that was giving them bad ports. The Amiga was getting bad games ported back to the ST also.
Okay.
They both systems lost with lazy, not lazy developers, but development houses that did not put enough time and money into the games for these computers.
Interesting comparison, Jeff. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to our feedback.
Feedback.
So here from podcast number 106, Redemption for Game Maker, Once Upon Atari book review. Great review of HSW's memoir. I read it a couple years ago, but this reminded me of how good it is. Kudos on keeping the review episode brief and no need to pad it out. Perfectly sized, bite-sized listen. That's by Dave Schmidt, who is basically trying to tell us to shorten your damn podcast down.
Yes, exactly.
And here, this
friend of the show.
Yeah.
Friend of the
this
show.
This one's going to be like an hour or something. So now here's another one from this one. I wish you would reconsider playing music in the background of your podcast. It's very distracting and takes away from your awesome podcast. This is Bert Capri. And I did listen to this. And I went in the car and listened to this. And he was right. As a podcast, the music was too loud. And so
Bert,
we took Bert's advice to heart. And I think we're going to limit the music that goes behind us talking.
Oh, yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
So there won't be any in this either. Okay. More feedback. This is to the Mr. Postman games from BitCorp Worse Than ET. I think this is the first time I heard you drop an F-bomb. This is not true, but it's pretty funny. I think he said that. Mr. Postman actually looks decent and fun. It just requires reading or perhaps more accurately deciphering the manual first. From everything I've heard, ET is the same. You have to read the manual first. Thanks for another fun video. So this is from our series of finding games that are worse than ET, or evaluating games to see if they are worse than ET.
I think especially games. With Mr. Postman, it was a very ambitious game.
Yeah, it's like very ambitious. ET. Yeah.
Very ambitious for, it was, you know, they were trying.
Yeah. It's ambitious. It's just like it's by the same people who made Bobby is Going Home, and it's an ambitious game. Okay, another piece of feedback I threw in here. This is for Worser Than Worser, the Games of Mythicon. The TIA chip. Not the TIA chip. It is not an acronym. Actually, I want to say it is an acronym because that's what acronym means, that each letter it means something. Acronym. It is an acronym, but you don't necessarily pronounce acronyms. So, I mean, we'll try to say TIA, but I want to say, like, NASA is also an acronym where each letter means something and people pronounce it NASA. So I think it really depends on who you talk to, whether you pronounce or pronounce the name, spell it out, or pronounce each letter. It just depends. Some people do, some people don't. I like to say Tia because I think it sounds cool.
I like Tia. I like it because Maria came from Tia, and the Maria chip is...
So did GTIA, the GTIA. And we say GTIA, right? We
don't say GTIA, but not...
Not Jatia, so...
Jatia. So he's... I mean, yeah, no one says Jatia.
I think it's almost situational when you decide what you're doing. So, all right.
That's okay.
That's the end, and this is the Creator Spotlight. So, Creator Spotlight. We decided we're going to try something. We're gonna find a creator that we like, that we don't necessarily know if they're popular or not. I don't know. But I like this person and the work that they do, and I thought I would spotlight them. And this is something that we've never done. So this is Silicon Underground, Dave Farquhar, the computer security professional, trained hobbyist, and landlord. I love that. So Dave has a website called the Silicon Underground, and it is a blog. Updated every single weekday with compelling little stories and histories, thoughts and commentaries. He covers Atari, Commodore, DOS, retro computing, video game machines, other retro stuff, and lots of other things too. He had this recent article that I really liked about piracy on the Commodore 64, a memoir. It's a memoir probably for everyone who grew up in the 80s who had a computer. And you had something to say about this, right, Jeff?
So interesting that I was reading through this and I really liked the way the Commodore 64 guys were all stereotyped as dirty, dirty pirates, the same way the Atari guys were. But the difference was there was enough Commodore 64 people to sustain a market. There wasn't with the Atari, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, the Atari actually was well known to die because of piracy.
Right.
And there weren't enough. It was the same sort of pirate market. There just weren't enough mainstream Atari users the way there were mainstream Commodore users.
Right.
Most Atari users were engineers and people who Tinkers. Quickly figured out that you could copy software and did, and didn't really, there, no one understood at the time that this was going to destroy the software industry for their computer. So, and a lot of them had come from a time, honestly, when software was free.
Free, yeah.
You know, they were older, you know, again, boomers, but they were growing up, they were working in computer centers and stuff in the 70s when software was free, and this whole idea about buying software was new. I mean, they should have figured it out.
Right.
I'm just giving them the
benefit
of the doubt. I
know that people use that as an excuse, and it is an excuse. It was a revolution from non having to pay for software to having to pay for it, right? But when you get to the commercial aspects, this software was available lots of places before 1984. It dropped off after that. So basically, when we started buying software, it started drying up. But before that, it was available everywhere. It was expensive, but people should have been supporting their computer. That's
so. Let's continue about Silicon Underground. So why does he call it Silicon Underground? He says, I've always been a fan of underground computers, the stuff nobody else talks about that inspired the name. For a long time, I wrote mostly about technology. I drifted into other topics since then, but I kept the name. It's fairly easy to remember and a lot easier to spell than my last name. So some of the recent topics, you know, I know he says he's drifted away, but recently he's had stories about the Odyssey 2, Fairchild Channel F, the first CD-ROM drive, Atari Portfolio, Emerson Arcadia 2001. These are all fun articles to read, by the way. But the thing I wanted to say was that you go to his archive page, and the archive page only lists the last 2,000 articles that he's written. because again, he writes one every day. And I would, I mean, it's fascinating how much Dave has written on Silicon Underground. I think that that people should go check it out. It's a great, it's a blog still. I've actually written to him a couple times, suggested that he make little videos about it. But I know how much work that is, and I know it's hard to get started. But I think, you know, his little articles are like the fodder for a great podcast.
Right.
So that's video podcast. Anyway, check out Silicon Underground. It's really cool.
Love it.
So, the boardroom debate. You ready?
Ready. What's
the boardroom debate? I did it again. We used the. I think we may actually keep this. We
okay,
actually
this, keep this is the boardroom debate. Board. Yeah. B-O, I'm not bored yet. Anyway,
No, I know, because that, remember, that's what sparked last week's debate.
I know.
Was the boardroom debate.
Here's wait, just debate. Anyone who's watching, we know how to spell the word board. Just this is
right.
We know that board is spelled a different way than this. This means, just in case someone wants to tell us in the comments how to spell board. It's B-O-A-R-D, and it's not an acronym. Okay.
Right. I know. I mean, this is a bad pun is what it is.
It's a bad pun, right.
That we've used like four times. Here is the debate. Can retro save the game industry? So I'm going to play this about a minute of this video for you, and then we'll talk about it, okay?
Good.
We are here for GDC 2024.
It has grown game.
We also have a big focus on looking back.
This is the vinyl to streaming music.
There's just so many great ideas in old games. Almost every new game that comes out that's super exciting has an old game that actually kind of inspired it.
This really is this fun. And when something's fun, you want to keep playing it.
Many games have been lost from even 15 years ago.
It's why a conference about the game industry's future is now also focused on preserving its past.
You know, preserving these games are important because it's an art form.
Meet Wade Rosen, the 36-year-old CEO of a company you might have heard of, Atari.
I always joke we're a 50-year-old startup.
When he took over in 2021, he made a bold decision
to really say, hey, let's focus on retro classic gaming and be the best in the world at that.
Founded in the 70s. Right.
So it's a pretty good news report about GDC and Atari. Obviously, it's, you know, all sort of news reports play like the audience is stupid, but
right.
But it's a pretty good one. But I think the point of this question is, if you see this, is they're sort of looking back to retro at the GDC this year and figuring out, is retro going to save the game industry? Because right. Someone needs something to save the game industry. So my question to you, Jeff, is can retro save the game industry?
I think retro has already started and is in made very good progress towards saving the game industry, because the aspects of the games that are coming out now, not everyone's making money at this, but the aspects of the games that are coming out in the lower budget games and the ones you find on Steam, even the smaller games like Cave Story that came out on multiple platforms and came out on the Switch, you're finding people taking these niche ideas, these things that don't need to be 500 terabytes of data downstream to your machine to play the full motion video game. I know it's a full motion video.
So wait, are you referring to like indie games? Like, are you saying the spirit of indie games?
Yes, the spirit of
indie games is really what this. What
it's indie, but also it is the aesthetic of retro. It is the retro and retro technology or retro ideas too. Like indie games that are using those. You've seen them all over. You did Scar. Is it Scarred last? What was
Scarred
last week. I mean, those ideas are what will and will continue to save and drive the industry. It's almost like I can watch one Avengers movie a year. I'm not really a big Avengers fan, but I can watch 100 indie movies on Netflix and be much more enjoyable with the stories than I will with one huge $5 billion movie that's made and comes out, because I get much more entertainment from those 100 smaller independent movies.
What I want to know is, will the actual retro game save the game industry?
They can help people make
money. I guess
money.
You were. When you're talking about those movies, you were kind of thinking about that, though,
well,
right?
What I'm thinking is, like, so if you can... Okay. if you need to, if EA and Activision need to make a couple games that literally cost, you know, $200 million a year, how do you afford that? If the game's going to make $1 billion and it costs $200 million, awesome, right? Record companies used to use that idea to fund smaller games. But I think it's actually going to work the other way.
Smaller games or smaller albums? I think what you're saying is the record industry used to say, hey, for every albums, Michael Jackson,
they used to have a billion seller that helped fund the smaller ones. I think retro games might work the opposite way. All these small games people are paying $20 for making money that are retro aesthetic, classic, may help these companies get to the point to help them afford to make their $200 million game a year, because no one, that may be the only way they can do it.
I don't know, though. I don't know. See, I don't know if that's how, I don't know if a lot of people are making money even on their small games anymore.
Oh, okay.
I don't think that happens. I think the problem is that you've got a lot of indie game developers that don't make anything.
Right.
They'd hardly make any money. And now you've got these big companies saying they can't make enough money. And so they're laying a bunch of people off because they're literally like, you know, having to maximize shareholder value based on the two games they release every year.
Yes.
So the point is that I think the question is, can the ideas of what it used to be to make games and what we used to do save the game industry, as opposed to just the games themselves? You know, for example, like you said, like I remember going to the game store and there'd be 20 games out every week,
right?
And you could choose from them, right? now there's hardly a game released a week.
Yeah, I would say that
a AAA game.
If you go back to, I think that if they went back and someone examined the actual European and English game market between 1984, let's say, and 1991, when you had five main platforms, you had the ST, you had the Amiga, you had the Commodore 64, you had the ZX Spectrum, and then eventually you got the CPC in there, and there were other smaller platforms in there. Those platforms were easily supported and supported an industry of games selling for a relatively decent price. Now, those $20 games for the ST and Amiga are $60 now, right? But they're $60. That's what you see games being sold for now. If someone went back and said, how did they do it? You would see people doing all those aesthetic, smaller games, games without huge graphics, retro style games, because they weren't retro at the time. All of those things supported an industry of many companies doing much better than American companies. Of course, these companies, these small companies, they didn't survive, many of them, into the giant console era because it became all about blockbuster games.
Well, I think a lot of those companies were run on a shoestring.
No, they were. They were run on a shoestring, but they were making money. And that's the thing is, when it became all about blockbuster games, we got to the point now where no one can survive, right?
Right. Well, you've got an undercurrent of like anyone can make a game, and lots of people do make games, and the games don't make enough money.
Right.
They may make a little money, but not enough money. And then you've got big games, but they also now don't make enough money for the companies. Like no one's making enough money. But do we think actually retro, like actually Atari and what they've been doing to like collect up IP and
yes,
reimagine it and re-release it? Do you think they have something that other people don't? Do you think they're going to be successful? Can it be recreated by other people?
There's only one Nintendo. There's only one Disney of video games at the moment. Now, it should have been Atari, but Atari fumbled the ball a long time ago.
It absolutely should have been Atari. Looking at the stuff that Atari was doing at the end of the VCS with all the Disney games and stuff like that, absolutely, if they were able to continue on, they would have become that, for sure.
So it's basically, since there's only one Nintendo might have to be the company that saves the video game industry. But they've been doing retro games. Retro games. They have the IP. They have the. Will Atari and yes, I think that there's room for Atari and Wade Rosen making the right decisions and actually making sure you can send out your product, right? where that idea,
as long as they can ship it,
yeah, where that idea will is where people are going. Everybody right now, everybody is into some sort of retro game. That's not saying they're all into Atari or Nintendo, but kids who are now 19 remember the games they played 10 years ago that are sort of retro, but they like those games because they can actually play them. You know, they can actually emulate them too. Right. So retro is now what was 5, 10 years ago for you. It's no longer 30 years, 40 years. It's whatever they were playing before.
So that is interesting that your kids are playing the games that are just like 10 years old.
Right.
And going back to them because they're games they can actually play.
And they've come out on Steam, as opposed to, you know.
So I mean, Atari has like bought Night Dive. You know, they're resurrecting Infogrames, which is probably a ton of content on Infogrames that Infogrames owns. That's
right.
That's IP that they could release. You know, they Digital Eclipse, of course, they bought, which only do emulation, or they specialize in emulation and doing Atari 50 and doing those museum discs. You can see a lot more of that museum, a lot more of the things that they're doing. They've got remakes of older games, that's what Night Dive, or remastering of old games, which is what Night Dive does. They've got museum quality, like retro collections.
Yeah, those are fantastic.
They have their own IP to re-release on various platforms and consoles. And then they have their own reimagined new games that they're making. I mean, they actually have their finger in a lot of places, but it is very consistent, I think, what they're trying to do.
So between the years of 1987 and like 1992, and maybe even beyond, Infogrames released about 80 games for the Atari ST, about 90 for the Amiga, maybe even more for the Amiga in later years. That's a lot of games that, this is a company that started then, kept going, and bought Atari. So what did Infogrames do back then that they could replicate now? Well, the smaller games, smaller development, focusing on a couple good things, but also using those same ideas. You're talking about games from way back that they're not using anymore. There's ideas you can mine from the ST to Amiga. Put those on game packs, but do something with it, you know, do something with that, all that IP they have from back then also. They have a lot of their own.
Yeah, a lot of it they just published that it might not actually own it. Right, it just depends, but that's what they need to do, is find out what they're.
But there's
own.
A lot of RPGs that they had back then that could use another, like Draken and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of games that just died, and there's a lot of things. So I think by these companies going back and mining their stuff, the ideas, redoing some of them for the new age, you have already a game that's been designed. It's programmed, but you need reprogrammed. It's designed. The story's done. You need new art. And you need a new way to get it out. These are games that could just be redone and put out on Steam for the PC. You know, things like that. There are ways to do that. Make it, the games are good and they're there.
Yeah, I think that. So the question is, can retro save the game industry? I think the answer is retro is saving the game industry,
and it can. Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, that is the weekly overscan for this week.
That is the end of the weekly overscan.
Hopefully we get it edited in time.
We will.
I say we because I know I'm going to make you do it.
I'm not editing it this time. I know. I'm working on my ST video right now.
Cool. Okay. Well, in because of that, Jeff, we're out of the overscan and...
Into the vertical blank.
Into the vertical blank.
We were children of the Silicon Revolution, an X generation conscripted to fight the console and home computer wars. A product of an analog 70s childhood, we came of digital age in the 80s, believing we could affect the world 8 bits at a time. Armed with joysticks, full-stroke keyboards,
Jolt Cola, and MTV haircuts, we proceeded into the vertical blank. There, we stayed up late at night, devising incantations from D&D rulebooks and beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code. Video games were the match, and programming was the fuse, as the infinite possibilities of the digital world exploded into the internet age to come. We are Generation Atari.
Into the vertical blank.